Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Coach's Corner. This is Coach Andrew Poritz from Ingenuity Coaching. And tonight we're going to have a very, very different show than we have. First of all, let me tell you a little bit about myself. I can be found at myfuturecoach.com and on Twitter at twitter.com/CoachAndrew. Now, tonight, my guest is Dan Orth. Sorry about that. I just had a little bit of a technical difficulty. Dan Orth is a record producer, a songwriter, and he's the owner of and CEO and founder of Lounge Renown Records. And tonight we're going to talk about Dan and his story and the music business today. Dan, are you there?
I'm here, Andrew.
Great to have you on board.
Thank you very much. It's a I'm thrilled to be on your show today.
Well, thank you. So you have a very, very interesting career. And first of all, you're not a spring chicken, shall we say. You've been around for a long time.
That is correct, Andrew. Yeah, I have a very interesting story. And when the listeners hear my story, hopefully I will be an inspiration to others, people my age.
So just to get a little bit of a background about you, how did you come to the music business in the first place?
Very good question. Okay. When I was a very young kid, I was 1956. I was 8 years old, and I heard an Elvis Presley song. The name of the song was that great Elvis song, Don't Be Cruel.
Mm.
At that moment, when I was 8 years old, I fell in love with rock and roll music. I just fell in love with that song, Don't Be Cruel, and other Elvis Presley songs. So in my schooling, from grammar school to junior high school to senior high school to college, English was always my best subject. So when I graduated from college, like a lot of kids that go to college and then graduate from college, I really didn't know what I wanted to do for a living.
Mm-hmm.
But I entertained the thought of becoming a newspaper reporter, journalist, or a magazine journalist. I know that I would have been successful because English was always my best subject. And from the time I was a little kid, I remember I was in the fourth grade, and it was myself and three other students in that fourth grade class. The teacher gave me and the three other students books to read because we were the best students in the class.
Do you remember any of the books you read, by the way, in that fourth grade class?
I don't remember.
Okay.
I don't remember, but I'm using my fourth grade class as an example to bring home the point that English has always been my best subject out of all my subjects in my education. And so I received a lot of B's, sometimes A's in English, and was very good at creative writing, da-da-da. So that's why I thought to myself, okay, when I was graduating from college, maybe I'll be a newspaper reporter, newspaper journalist, or a magazine journalist.
Mm-hmm.
But then I said to myself, I love rock and pop music so much, I'm going to be a songwriter. And I never have regretted it.
So what was the very first song you wrote?
The very first song I wrote were some songs that I wrote myself, the words and the melodies. Some of the titles were Hiring Hall Blues was one song. Another song that I wrote, I actually collaborated on this song with another songwriter. It was called Mexican Slow Train, which is autobiographical about a trip that I had made with a friend to to Mexico. I live in Oakland, California, Northern California here, and so Southern California and Mexico aren't that far away. So I was a young man in my 20s, and a friend of mine and I had taken a trip to Mexico, and we were in Mexicali, and we had a choice of taking either the fast train or the slow train to go down to Mazatlan and Puerto Vallarta. So we ended up on the slow train. It's a very interesting trip. And so that's where I came up with that song titled Mexican Slow Train, which is a very, very good song that I collaborated on with another songwriter. So, okay, so we have Hiring Hall Blues, we have Mexican Slow Train, we have, okay, another song title of a song that that I wrote on my own. The title of this song is Julie T, which is an autobiographical song about a girl I was dating, and a beautiful girl, and then things didn't work out, and I expressed the lyrics I expressed in that song was the disappointment of my relationship with Julie T not working out. Then another song title that I wrote around that time where I wrote the words and melody, a song called Love Is Everywhere. So that's another song, original song title of mine.
Do you know so that?
And then I have other, from around that time, I have other titles, interesting titles that that I would really, I'd have to tax my brain a little bit, but that gives you an idea.
I'm just curious, because when you're talking about this woman that you had feelings for and you wrote about it, do you find that the tragedy of love is one of the greatest inspirations for music?
I wouldn't say, well, no, I'll answer yes, because it's not for me.
Mm-hmm.
For me, as a songwriter, it isn't that subject. You know, love and the, love.
Yeah, I mean,
I know, and I know it is for, you know, there have been so many songs written on that subject, you know, and including hit songs, you know, which has been a very well-covered subject. But for me as a songwriter, that's not my favorite. It's not my favorite subject.
When you spoke about that particular song, it made me think of, for example, Adele, who's had this brilliant career based on really her breakup. Like she had an whole album.
I'm familiar
breakup.
With her, the young British girl. I'm familiar with her.
Yeah.
You're right, and I think I know. I can't think of the title of the song that you're talking about, but it's about romance. Yeah.
Yeah, it's like the whole album came from. Not a bad romance like Lady Gaga's bad romance, but a romance gone bad that turned into a whole album. So I just made me think of.
Oh, so that's very interesting. I had no idea because I don't have Adele's album on CD, and so I didn't know that's the whole concept, the whole subject matter of the album. That's
I haven't listened to more than a couple of songs, but I remember her talking about it. I've heard her speaking of it, and that was what inspired this album and it made it such a powerful album. And here you have, one of your earliest songs came out of a heartbreak, really.
Right. I guess we can define it as that because she was so beautiful. Julie T was so beautiful.
Mm.
She was like a dream girl, and that got away. Which looking back on my life autobiographically, the dream girls were always the toughest ones to hold on to. And lyrically in that song, I remember the lyrical lines that I wrote expressing my sadness about losing Julie T. But it always works out this way. The girls that I want get away, while the girls I don't care for would love to have me forevermore. Yes, I remember.
Look, we got a little singing snippet now out of you. That's great.
I haven't sang that song in a long time, and I hope it was all right. But I think I can sing it better.
That's okay. So, who sang your songs? Actually, that's another question.
Oh, that's a very good question. Okay, who sang my songs?
Mm-hmm.
Okay, the year. Okay, I became, as I mentioned earlier. At the time I graduated from college, and I said to myself, okay, I'm going to become a songwriter. Okay.
Mm-hmm.
So at that time, I had a very good friend of mine at St. Mary's College in Moraga, which is a Catholic school here on the in Northern California.
Mm-hmm.
He was just a dynamite guitar player. And he had, Tim was his name, and Tim gave me my first guitar lessons.
Mm-hmm.
And I had my parents had given me guitar lessons, but it was a completely as a young kid when I was like 10 years old. That's Hawaiian guitar, which is the same thing as pedal steel guitar.
Oh,
where
right.
Where you have picks on your right hand and then you have a bar on your left hand. Of course, that pedal steel guitar is very popular in country music.
Mm-hmm.
So I knew how to play. And it's also called Hawaiian guitar. And but I never had learned to play regular guitar, so that's interesting that when I was at St. Mary's College, a junior there, after transferring from a two-year junior college here in Oakland, one of my new and best friends at St. Mary's College in Moraga was just a dynamite guitar player. And so I had got that guitar, that same guitar that I went home at my parents' house, picked up, got that guitar and put some steel strings on it, and my buddy Tim had given me my first guitar lessons on regular guitar. So I actually took up the instrument regular guitar much later than a lot of guitarists take up the instrument. So I was a junior in college, so I was like 20 years old when I first started learning regular guitar.
But do you remember, the guy's name just went out of my head, the very famous singer, Kenny Rankin. Remember Kenny Rankin?
That name certainly rings a bell, yes.
Singer, songwriter, phenomenal singer, and actually a phenomenal guitar player. And what's really interesting about him is he didn't start playing the guitar until, I think, his late 20s.
I'm sure glad you told me that, Andrew. I had no idea, so I'm not alone.
No, you're not
I'm
alone.
I'm not alone. Where I started playing regular guitar at 20 years old, and he didn't even Kenny Rankin didn't even start learning to play guitar in his late 20s.
Yeah, if I'm remembering correctly,
but
the age.
That's a
but
very,
I remember
very
being
interesting
very
story,
interesting
and I. And I believe you that you said that he's a great guitar player.
Oh,
I remember him very much as for his hit songs, and he's got a really nice singing voice, and he's a really good recording artist.
Mm-hmm.
I really can't remember his guitar playing. But now that you've mentioned this to me, I'm going to look him up online and on YouTube videos and pay attention to his guitar playing. So he played guitar in a lot of his songs, huh?
Yeah, I don't know if you know the song "Undone" by the Guess Who.
I love the Guess Who. I love the
song,
Guess Who.
You know the song "Undone." She's come undone.
Oh yes, absolutely. Yeah.
And,
yes.
Really interesting guitar work. Randy Bachman from eventually was Bachman Turner Overdrive, was the guitar player for the Guess Who, and that's a very jazzy little piece of guitar work. Turns out he had listened to a Kenny Rankin song, an early Kenny Rankin song, that made him want to learn those kind of changes. And he did, and he created that song based on what he was listening to.
Very interesting, Andrew. So he was Randy Bachman, the great Randy Bachman, who's a great, great guitar player.
Oh,
very
absolutely.
Familiar with Randy. So he was very much influenced by Kenny Rankin's guitar playing. That's very interesting story.
Hmm.
Now, we got sidetracked a little bit.
Sorry,
Amber, you asked me, okay, who sang my song?
Who sang your song?
That's a very good question, which I'm now going to answer, okay? I am what we call a home musician, where I'm a guitar player and I sing to write songs,
mm-hmm.
and I also play harmonica and I play tambourine,
mm-hmm.
maybe a few other things, and so I'm like I call myself a home musician. So me as a songwriter, I have since the 1970s. I've had some good recorders.
Mm-hmm.
Some good recorders.
Right.
Reel to reel cassette tape recorders, and so I would record my original songs with these tape recorders.
Right.
Okay. So, but 1978 was a very exciting year for me, and so I had, and this was not the first time that I had in networking and seeking out collaborators, other songwriters, and at that time I was looking for singers and recording artists to work with at that point in time,
mm-hmm.
in 1978. So I ran across a guy, his name is Phil Phillips. And this Phil Phillips, incidentally, is not the same Phil Phillips who recorded that great song, Sea of Love. That's not that's not the same Phil Phillips. But this Phil Phillips is just a phenomenal singer, guitarist, songwriter, recording artist, performer. And Phil is a little bit older than I am. So in 1978, in my networking pursuits, just talking to people, other songwriters,
mm-hmm.
musicians, etc., I ran across a guy who was attended Cal Berkeley, which is very close by here in Oakland. Berkeley is
mm-hmm.
right next to Oakland, you know, the famous Cal Berkeley campus. And Armando Cesarini was his name. He put out, he had just graduated from Cal Berkeley, and he put out this flyer called The Progressive Musician. So I put my ad in there that I was looking for other songwriters and preferably singers and recording artists. So Phil Phillips answered my ad. So that turned out to be a very, very exciting thing. And a very interesting thing about that ad that I placed in Armando's Progressive Musician, I wrote in this little, in my ad, that I had been to the famous Automat recording studios in San Francisco,
mm-hmm.
and I walked in off the street. So it was quite an accomplishment for me just to get in the famous Automat recording studios in San Francisco.
Mm-hmm.
And in my ad in the Progressive Musician, I wrote that I had Jeff Cohen, who worked with David Rubinson, who owned the Automat recording studios. I had Jeff read some lyrics that I had written him. At that point, when I was first got into the Automat, I didn't have any of my songs, completed songs, on like cassette tape with me to play anybody at the Automat, but I had just had some lyrics, and so Jeff loved my lyrics, and so the reason I'm telling this story is when Phil Phillips answered my ad in the Progressive Musician, he took the bait that I was in my quest to try and attract some really talented singer, songwriter, recording artists, performers,
mm-hmm.
that Automatic worked. Me listing the fact that I was let into the Automat just cold off the street, and so Phil picked up on that. And talking about the Automat recording studios in San Francisco, which at that time was the hottest recording studio in Northern California. David Rubinson owned the studio, and David Rubinson had, I'm sure the listeners out there, this will ring a bell to people, he was instrumental and managed Tower of Power.
Oh, yeah.
The
sure.
famous funky Tower of Power right mm-hmm. at the beginning. And then he worked with Carlos Santana, and Santana, who recorded The Automat. He, David, was the, conceived the Chambers Brothers.
Really?
And managed the Chambers Brothers. That, remember they had that hit song in the psychedelic era, the early, was late 60s, early 70s, Time Has Come Today.
Yeah, that
yeah,
song
yeah,
used to
yeah,
scare
yeah.
me, by the
okay,
way.
Okay, and then at the Automat Studios, I'm sure this will ring a bell with listeners, the famous singer-songwriter Phoebe Snow,
mm-hmm.
who did that great song, Poetry Man, she recorded at the Automat. Then we have the Pointer Sisters. David managed, at that point in their career, David managed the Pointer Sisters. And I remember when I was there at the Automat Studios in San Francisco, and I looked at the gold and platinum records hanging on the walls, there was a Billboard chart, and it had that song of the Pointer Sisters, Bet You Got a Chick on the Side. And that was, and it was way up on the Billboard charts, and that was David Rubinson's Pointer Sisters. So that gives you an idea of the famous Automat recording studio.
Is the Automat still there?
No, it isn't. What happened at some point in the 1980s, David Rubinson ran into some financial difficulties. One of the problems was the fact that some of the clients didn't pay their bills for their recording time when they recorded at the Automat,
mm-hmm.
including, I heard the story, I never did find out the name, but I read it in the news, local San Francisco Chronicle, maybe a magazine here in Northern California, including a big name recording artist and didn't pay his bills for his recording time there at the Automat. And so David Rubinson, very unfortunately, he got into some financial difficulties.
Hmm.
And then some, I believe it was some tax problems with the IRS, and so
mm-hmm.
unfortunately he had to give up the famous Automat.
No, was this in the 80s that he gave it up?
I'll take a guess that it was in the decade of the 80s, somewhere in the 80s. I don't think it made, I'm not absolutely sure, but I don't think the Automat made it into the 90s. I might be incorrect. We could look that up online.
Well, you know, the ironic thing is, you know, when I hear the term Automat, I'm sure a lot of other people of a certain age will, I think of the New York Horn and Hard Art Automat, you know, the food place where you would get the automated, semi-automated food. I don't know if you're familiar with that.
I just
movies.
Learned something. So in the Big Apple in Manhattan, there was a fast food place or a restaurant called
sorts.
The Automat, huh?
There was they were like luncheonettes or places where you get lunch or dinner, and you would put in a nickel and get a sandwich.
Ornate vending
machines. And
why it was called the Automat, I bet, because it was like
yeah.
that.
No,
you could suit all your needs wherever you wanted by just putting coins in vending
pretty
machines.
Much. I mean, they had people who would put food in behind these things, and they had some servers who would come around, and I guess certain things they would do, take your plates away. But everything was done by your machine, and then they had a coffee machine. It was very, very nice, and not like an upper class thing. But a lot of people went to them, and ironically, the Automat, and the very last Automat went out of business in the late middle or late 80s.
Oh, that's very interesting. So in the Big Apple in Manhattan, New York City, there was that famous eating place, the Automat, with the same name. Very interesting.
And if you ever see the movie with Marilyn Monroe singing Diamonds Are a Girl's Best Friend, and I think it was actually the same title, wasn't it, or was it... another title.
I remember that Marilyn Monroe song very well.
She mentions the automat in the song.
In the movie.
In the song itself. It's in the song.
Oh, excuse me, in the song.
The theme song.
Oh, and
Diamonds Are a Girl's Best
Friend.
I'm
going to go to YouTube sometime soon, and I'm going to... Very interesting.
Yes,
very
I am a font of useless information, Dan.
You know, that's a very similar thing that you and I have. We're like walking encyclopedias.
Yeah.
I love it. And talking about that, it's paying dividends for me. Because when I started my Dan Orth Facebook page, okay, now all the listeners out there know that Dan Orth, O-R-T-H, has a Facebook page. And that is how I met you.
That's
Andrew,
right.
Not that long ago on Facebook. And so Facebook, I just love Facebook and this networking. Here you have this Blog Talk radio show, and you are a rock and pop music walking encyclopedia.
I am.
Like me. That's what I picked up about you, because I believe it was on that great site from our Facebook friend, Sherry Arm, who has that great site called Sounds of the 70s, I think that's where I ran across you.
It could be, although I was thinking, do you know Kevin Conway, who's a radio guy in California?
No, that name is completely foreign to me.
Okay, he's in Sacramento, because I know I'm on his page, and then we eventually also became Facebook friends. So I know that it was something to do with music that we connected on.
That you and definitely.
Yeah.
Definitely. And you had mentioned something about a song or a YouTube music video that I picked up on.
Mm.
Yeah. So that so talking about what we're talking about, okay, so I'm happy to report that on my Dan Orth Facebook, I now have 1,100 people from around the world that subscribe to me, which I very much like, because me being seriously involved in the music business, and I have my current record label, Lounge Renown Records, and I have my fabulous Patton Leather band, P-A-T-T-O-N, then Leather, L-E-A-T-H-A, Patton Leather, and Dwayne Patton is the leader of our band.
Ah, okay, I was wondering how the name came about.
He's the male lead vocalist of Patton Leather, and I love that name, Patton Leather. You know, it comes from Dwayne's name instead of Patton Leather, Patton Leather. And we do a lot of funk. We do a lot of funk. So Leather is like the funky way instead of leather, you know, Leather. And so Patton Leather, the fabulous Patton Leather band, is a hip-hop, R&B, funk, and rock band, which is very, very interesting. We cover a lot of territory. And I've been working with Patton Leather now for 3.5 years.
Mm.
And we've recorded a fabulous album of 11 original songs and 3 cover songs. And I'm very happy to report that I am a co-songwriter on 8 of the 11 original songs. And then me as music supervisor. A music supervisor is somebody that is in charge of song selections for recording projects.
Right.
I'm so happy about this, that all of the musicians in the fabulous Patton Leather band, because they respect me and they showed their love for me, they gave me 80% creative control of each and every song selected for the album. And that just meant the world to me. And at this point in time, myself being 64 years old, age is only a number, the rest of my career, I'm really going to benefit by this. Because looking back on my career and working with other songwriters, singers, recording artists, musicians, everybody listened to me, but in a lot of cases, they didn't listen to me enough. So the point I'm making, the rest of my career in the music business, when I'm working with people, including young, up-and-coming singers, songwriters, recording artists, performer, they're going to have to listen to me a lot closer, or I'm going to tell them, hey, you know, you're gonna have to do this song, you're going to have to do this song, or I'm not working with you.
Right.
And that's a very important point, because talking about what I'm talking about, okay, like since 1978, when I got together with the great Phil Phillips, singer, songwriter, recording artist, performer, who is just a very, very talented guy. And then we co-wrote 17 great songs together, so we always had those songs. And when I was working with Phil, we had a twofold goal. One of the goals was for him to get signed to, or the Phil Phillips Band, our band, the Phil Phillips Band, one of the goals was to get signed to a major record label.
Right.
And there was more than one major record label that was interested in signing us. But close only counts in horseshoes. And it was utterly devastating. Very devastating.
Yeah,
and,
sure.
And heartbreaking, where these major record labels who should have signed us,
mm-hmm.
they cost themselves a lot of money. They cost Phil and I a lot of money and our careers at that point in time, in like 1978, 1979,
right.
1980, when they were interested in the Phil Phillips Band.
Mm-hmm.
So there's that part of that story, but the twofold goal, okay, so I accomplished, it was a very exciting time for me in 1978, me being a very serious songwriter, when I got together with Phil Phillips and we wrote these 17 songs together, they just weren't good songs, they were great songs. So that was, so I accomplished that goal. That was very, very exciting for me to accomplish that goal, to write, co-write, and record great original songs.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought that I would live happily ever after. Boy, was I in for a rude awakening. But the other part of the twofold goal, okay, so I have all these great songs that Phil and I wrote, and then I have songs that I've written myself. The goal was to have established recording artists and performers on major record labels perform and record our songs. So talking about that end of things, of the two-part goal, I have a mountain of papers in my files, including from Elton John's publishing company in England.
Right.
Rocket Music Publishing Company. That was a very exciting thing. The A&R man for Elton John, Bernie Taupin's publishing company, he very much wanted to listen to some of our original songs. And I'll tell you how that came about. This is an example of the value of networking with other songwriters and musicians and singers, recording artists, et cetera. There was a guy right here in Oakland who had found out that Phil and I had started our independent record label, Hard Boiled Records, in 1979. I was just networking and, you know, through the grapevine and this and that, continuing to network. And so this guy told me, hey, you should send your record, your Hardboiled record, 45 RPM vinyl, side A, side B, send it into Billboard magazine, because they have an independent record label section, and they
right.
might make the announcement. And so I was happy to see that they did make the announcement. So this A&R guy for Elton John, Bernie Taupin's music publishing company in England had picked up a Billboard magazine and saw that. And then when that announcement was made in Billboard magazine, it had the mailing address for Hard Boiled Records. So that's how that came to be.
Mm-hmm.
So it's a very interesting story.
Yeah,
this is a very interesting story.
That's your
about
first record company that you started?
It's called Hard Boiled Records.
Yeah, but that was your first one.
First one, and Lounge Renown Records is my third. Now, when I say my third, there's the second label called CBH3 Records, named after the late Carl B. Hope III. God rest his soul. Carl passed like 3 years ago. I was executive producer of that five-song extended play EP for the compact disc for that project. That was CBH3 Records was started and owned by the late Carl B. Hope III, but I was executive producer on that project.
I'd like to ask you a question, Dan.
Yes.
You started a record company, you said, what year was that, 1979?
Yes, Hard Boiled Records.
Hard Boiled Records, and you started a Lounge Renown in 2009, correct?
2009, or was it 2000? Yeah, that's correct. Yeah, 2009.
Right.
That's right, Andrew. Yes, uh-huh.
Okay, so I would like to get an idea. You know, we've had a lot of change in the world of music and records. What are some of the differences of starting a record company in 1979 compared to 2009, 30 years later?
I think the most radical change is the Internet revolution.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, with the demise of, because of the Internet revolution and the downloading of songs, and then which led to the closing of all the record stores like Tower Records, Virgin Records,
HMV,
and, you know, all the major record change to go buy vinyl records, and then, you know, then vinyl died out, and then we had compact discs. So with the elimination of the record store chains, not only in the United States but all over the world, I think that as compared to 1979 to the year 2009, that is the most radical change.
So would you say it's harder today?
Now, that is a very, very good question, Andrew. Is it harder today for record labels?
Mm-hmm.
Well, I'll tell you one thing. My first response to your very good question is, especially for independent record labels,
right,
it's not easy to be successful for a variety of reasons.
Mm-hmm.
Of course, it's not that way. It never has been that way for major record labels. But independent record labels, it's very, very tough for independent record labels to succeed. And in the history of rock and pop music, there haven't been that many independent record labels that have been successful.
Right.
But I'm very confident, and I feel very good about Lounge Renown Records for a number of reasons, that Lounge Renown Records is going to be successful. We've been seeing the beginnings of success with Lounge Renown Records since 2009, when I started the label.
So now today, of course, nobody really uses vinyl anymore except for DJs, pretty much, or record enthusiasts who still want them. And now I'm hearing a lot of people saying, "Oh, I never buy CDs anymore." So where is in the record, which is now becoming a term that doesn't even mean what it used to mean? So what is music produced on now?
Okay, that's another very good question, Andrew. Let's not forget that, like in the Target chain stores,
mm-hmm.
and then we have Kmart, that thank God record stores are not completely extinct.
Yeah.
So we can go all over the United States, including where you live in New York City, and go buy our favorite CD albums that we want to buy.
So, in other words,
there's
still a market for physical music.
Yes.
Okay, great.
Yes. And then aside from I used Kmart and Target as examples. There are other chains that still do handle compact discs in their music sections of the stores. But also, like here in Northern California, like on the Cal Berkeley campus, we have, I guess we can call them the independent record stores that have been there for years. We have one called Amoeba Records, and then there's in Berkeley, and then there's an Amoeba Records in the Haight-Ashbury section of San Francisco. And then I forget the names of some of the other traditional record stores. So we do, we still do have regular record stores, but greatly diminished. So in the music business, it's calling having product,
right,
or you're having product for sale, you know, for the market. So what has radically changed, of course, is what a lot of music consumers, and especially young people, they'll download their favorite songs off of their computers. And then aside from just downloading their favorite individual songs, I think I'm correct on this. I've only been online myself, been online, and what an education I've received, like about 2.5 years. So I'm going to guess that music consumers can download an entire album, of course.
Oh, sure.
Yeah, right. Right.
I sometimes say this also, there's so much out and out theft of music. There's YouTube, which they're always fighting to get these things taken down. But the other day I was looking at some Beatles-related clips, and I discovered somebody had put up the entirety of Abbey Road.
The entirety in what format?
In video. That, in other words, you would play it on YouTube, and it would play the entire album for you.
Oh, very interesting.
Yeah.
That's very creative. Listening to an album on a YouTube video.
Yeah, I think it would just be like pictures or something. But the point being that there's so much...
And I'm glad that you mentioned that, Andrew, because now you've given me a brainstorm. I can do that with our Patton Leva Treasure album sometime down the line.
All right. That would be very cool.
Yeah, so thank you for mentioning that.
You're very welcome. Speaking of Patton Leather.
Yeah,
I gotta get
the
this
funky
right.
way.
He should have the his opening act should be Patton Oswalt, the comedian. I'm just kidding.
I'm not familiar with that. The reason I didn't laugh, I wasn't. I'm not familiar with that comedian.
Oh, he's a comedian.
But I'm laughing now.
He was on the King of Queens, I think, TV show. So you have graciously given me a copy of one of his songs to play. Would you like me to play it?
Oh, one of our Patton Leather songs?
Yes, sir.
Oh, please do. Yes, please do. And this song was written, incidentally, by me and Phil Phillips. And Phil's real name is Donald Allen Phillips. Mm. And it's such a great song. I told Patton Leather. As a matter of fact, what's very interesting about this song, Music for the People, I'm going to quickly tell everybody how I met Patton Leather.
Okay.
In my song pitching career, which I mentioned a few minutes ago, that was the twofold quest of Phil and I and my careers. Hey, get these songs covered by major label singer, recording artists, performers, and I came very close, and that Rocket Music Publishing thing wasn't the only story. I've got a mountain of papers of other big name singers who are very much interested in our songs, and that Rocket Music Publishing thing was so close. What happened? The A&R guy kept playing the song for like about 4 months. Playing it around for recording artists, pitching it to artists that he was working with, but it was heartbreaking. Nobody picked up the song. It was a beautiful song called, it was a beautiful ballad that Phil had written called Just Another Habit, and they offered us a very, very fair publishing deal. where they would keep 50% of the publishing, we would keep 50% of the publishing, and da da da. But talking, so in my song pitching career, and I hope the listeners know what that means. That song pitching is when songwriters, serious songwriters, you pitch your songs to people, other people in the music industry, and not just to the recording artists themselves, but to their music publishing company,
right,
their major record labels, their managers. If you can get a song into, like I used to do it with cassette tapes, you know, before compact disc came out, and you know, in that format, and get a song into like a roadie at a live music show, or a manager, or I got in the looking back from 1978 to the present, I've done it so many times I've lost track, you know, being at live music shows, and I was always successful in getting my package into somebody that was connected to the recording artist I was trying to get the songs to. And so I've done that so many times I've lost track. So I was in Reno, Nevada in early December of 2009, and I'm hanging out at this casino in Reno, Nevada called the Peppermill, Fabulous Peppermill Casino. Reno, Nevada is like a four-hour drive from where I live here in Oakland. And Lake Tahoe's close by, and it's the High Sierras, and it's just a beautiful Reno, and Lake Tahoe are just one of those beautiful places on earth. So I always get up there a few times a year, and so I'm just on a little vacation up there, and I'm hanging out, and I'm at the Peppermill Casino, and there's this band playing in the lounge. You know, at gambling casinos all over the United States, there's always lounge bands to entertain the gamblers.
Sure.
Right. So I'm hanging out there at the Peppermill, and they have these TV screens all over the Peppermill, and this band is playing, and I didn't know if it was like from a TV program or if it was if they were like playing a DVD of a band. I didn't know the band was actually playing there, but I asked one of the casino employees at the Peppermill, where is this band playing? I thought it was like from a TV program, and she told me, no, they're playing in the lounge. And she told me what lounge was, and I went over there, and these guys just continued to blow me away. I mean, they were just out of this world. And so I said to myself, I've got to talk to these guys.
Right.
And so me having done this so many times before, you know, since 1978, being very experienced in approaching musicians and bands, I found this little short ladder that led up to the stage, and I knew that when they took a break from their set that they were playing, they were playing 45-minute sets, that they would have to come off the stage off this little ladder. And so I made it a point to get there before anybody else got there. And it didn't surprise me that when they came off stage, there was a few fans waiting for them that wanted to talk to them. But I, having been very experienced in this kind of thing, I made sure that I was going to be first in line. So Dwayne Patton came off the stage, and then Jay Logan, my buddy, who is now my buddy Jay Logan, came off the stage, and then Mikhail Morgan, et cetera, et cetera. And I said hello to them. They were very nice. I introduced myself to Dwayne, and we exchanged business cards. And so me telling this story, I thought of this song, this great song, Music for the People, which is the Dan Orth, Phil Phillips song. It would fits these guys perfectly. And then I had some other songs that fit them perfectly, and that's the reason that I approached them. I said to myself, geez, I've got to talk to these guys because I have some songs that just fit these guys perfectly. So so that's the story I'm telling about Music for the People.
Okay.
And so they picked up on it, especially Jay, and so we made history here. So you're going to play the song now, Andrew?
I'm going to play the song now. Music for the people. I should put on my DJ voice for this. Okay, we got music for the people here on KBTR.
Right.
All right. Patton, da-da.
Music for the people. Okay, music.
Patton Leta, music for the people here on W Blog Talk Radio.
Great, Andrew. Great. Thank you very much for playing that song.
You're very welcome.
Song. So getting back to 1978, I have to remember this, and I'm sure glad I remembered this in that very exciting year for me.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, at that time, when I was working with Phil, And I said to myself, I know something has got to happen. We were the guitar players, bass players, drummers, keyboard players. We were working with singers, other singers, including backup singers. There was so much talent there, I knew something had to give. So it turned out in that very exciting, which turns out to be historical recording project at the Automat Studios in June of 1978, rock guitar ace Joe Satriani played lead guitar on all five songs.
Nice.
Thank you. And another very interesting thing about this whole thing is Hard Boiled Records is the first legitimate legal record label that Joe ever appeared on. And that was publicly documented in the January 1990 issue of Guitar Player magazine in a letter to the editor that I wrote to the magazine. And the two reporter journalists that interviewed Joe in the previous issue on this big interview they did with Joe, in Joe's discography, he didn't mention Hardboiled Records. I have no idea why he didn't.
Well, that's
and so I had to correct that, and I was so happy. I was so happy when I picked up my I subscribed to Guitar Player magazine. I picked up the issue and I saw my letter to the editor printed in Guitar Player magazine, public documenting that very interesting fact.
Oh, that's great. Yeah,
thank
I'm familiar
you.
With him. And I, by the way, I was a lead guitar player growing up as in a high school and college band, and I still play guitar today.
Great, great, Andrew.
Yeah.
And so I just learned something about you. I had no idea you're a musician yourself.
Oh, absolutely. I sing. My voice is in a movie that
oh,
you could
great,
rent.
Oh, great, great. Are you also a songwriter?
I'm not a songwriter. Every time I try to write songs, they come out funny, so I don't do it.
Well, there's definitely a possibility that you might want to work with some of my and our songs.
Well, you know, that would be very interesting. I am be very happy.
You're
to
open
talk
to
about
it.
That.
Good, good.
Thanks.
You're open to it.
I'm always open to new opportunities. So,
another thing, talking about Joe Satriani.
Just to let you know, we only have 2 minutes left in the show.
Right. I have to. Here's something very important to mention to the. To you and to the listeners, this is an idea of how rough the music business is.
Mm-hmm.
Not only for songwriters, for musicians. Joe Satriani, did not actually make a living in the music business until 10 years after he worked with us with his big breakthrough album, Surfing with the Alien.
Mm.
Until then, he made his living as a guitar teacher. That was his day gig, just like I had a day gig for a number of years.
Sure.
I had a day gig, you know, paid the rent, you know, everything else. And so Joe made his living as a guitar instructor, and he was a guitar teacher for Kirk Hammett of Metallica.
Mm-hmm.
Steve Vai, okay, a guitar player for the Counting Crows. Okay, let's see. There's another famous guitarist that the name's not coming to me right now, but there's another very famous guitarist.
Well, you know what, Dan, we literally have about a minute left, so right now what I'd like to do is have you tell us where we can find you.
At my Facebook, and I welcome listeners out there to Facebook message me, and then anybody that mentions that they listen to the show, want to be my Facebook friend, I have plenty of room for them. I'm not anywhere
great.
Near close to the 5,000 limit.
And, of course, your cousin
Lava also has a Facebook.
Okay.
And then Lounge Renown Records has a very nice website. Then we have three of our patent leather music videos on YouTube. The young man who films and produces our patent leather music videos is a movie director and a movie editor, Osa Kun, Khun,
Dan, I'm going to have to, sorry, cut you off. We're down to our last 15 seconds of the show. I want to thank you very much for being with me here on Coach's Corner. And you can find me, Coach Andrew, on Twitter at Coach Andrew and at myfuturecoach.com. Thanks for listening, and we'll see you in 2 weeks. Good night.